Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Dana Buckler Show. My name is Dana, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Michael Scott. How are you today?
I am doing well, man. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here as well. It's been a little while since you and I have had a chance to sit down and discuss a film, or in this case, a film franchise. For the listeners out there, I think they can tell by the opening theme music that we are on episode one of our next retrospective. This series is called Don't Fall Asleep, A Look at the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And this is part one. This is the big one for us. I mean, we've done Terminator, we've done Rambo, and as listeners will find out soon, this is a movie, this one in particular is a movie that has sort of been the bane of my existence since I saw it back in 1985. It's a film that has monumentally traumatized me, and we'll get into that. So, Michael, before we get into the discussion of 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street, I'm going to ask you right off the bat, what does the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise mean to you?
So, it actually, this one's going to be a bit interesting because I obviously love the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise like any sane human being does, but I have always been much more of a Friday the 13th and Halloween kind of guy. Nightmare's always been sort of third for me, so I'm actually really excited to sit down and do this retrospective, because I'll be honest, I haven't seen some of these movies in at least 20 years. I would imagine. I don't remember the last time I saw Nightmare on Elm Street 5 or Freddy's Dead. So I'm going to be really excited to go through these. That being said, it's also a franchise that has been a part of my life since the beginning. I didn't actually see the first one I saw was actually not Nightmare on Elm Street. I saw Nightmare on Elm Street 2 first when it came out on video, and then I went back and saw the first Nightmare on Elm Street. And again, my parents had very flexible standards about what's appropriate viewing for small children. So I was probably, nine when I saw these. And so they clearly had an influence on me and an impact on me. And I do, think Freddy is an all-time great character. So I'm really excited to talk about him. But I would be lying if I said that it had the same, that it was in the DNA and had the same special place in my heart that it does for a lot of people. So I think I'll kind of maybe bring a little bit of different perspective to it as we go throughout.
And that's interesting. And there's a part of me right now that wants to ask you so badly about seeing part two first and then going back to see part one, but we'll save that for the second episode. For me, this is the industry standard when it comes to the big horror movie franchises. Like everybody has sort of their favorite, like you said, Friday the 13th, the Halloween franchise. Some people like the Texas Chainsaw, some people like Hellraiser, but this one's for me. This is the standard for me. And this is because this is the franchise, the series. This is the one that I visited the most when I was younger. And I've told this story on a few podcasts, so I'll give the Cliff Note version of it. I was exposed, and I say exposed, to this film at the age of 7, and it severely traumatized me to the point where, I slept with my bedroom light on for 3 or 4 years. I was traumatized, and we'll get a little deeper into that. But before we get into a discussion about the film itself, we have to talk about Wes Craven sort of leading up to this. And this gives me an opportunity to plug a podcast that you and I both love. That's the F This Movie podcast. And what they're doing is what Patrick and Heather Wixon are doing is a very deep dive into the career of Wes Craven. And it's called Craven Craven. And it's on the F This Movie feed. Have you listened to it yet, Mike?
Yeah, I have listened to, as of this recording, there are 2 episodes out. I've listened to both of them. Anybody that knows me knows that I absolutely adore Patrick and Heather. And so I was super excited. And I think it's a terrific podcast, especially if you want more to know more about Craven himself and how his sort of career trajectory went. I really recommend everybody that listens to this should absolutely listen to that.
And we're not going to spend as much time on each one of his films leading up to A Nightmare on Elm Street, because again, they're doing it really well. They're doing one episode per movie, and I strongly recommend it. I would also like to mention that a few years ago, Jim Hemphill and I did an Icons episode on Wes Craven. where Jim gives a very detailed and really interesting look at Craven's career. And he had an opportunity to interview Wes Craven. He talks a little bit about that interview. So I strongly recommend you listen to that episode as well. We're just going to kind of just go down the list real quick here, Mike. In 1972, The Last House on the Left, this is a film that I've seen a couple of times, and I revisited it after the Craven podcast. And I'll just say how I feel about the film. It's utterly disturbing to me, and I get the controversy, and it's a movie that I'm glad I've seen, but it's not one that I can just openly recommend. Hey, if you've never seen a Wes Craven film, here, check this out. What are your thoughts on The Last House on the Left?
Yeah, I mean, a legendarily infamous movie for a reason. I think it's a movie that most people, especially if you consider yourself any type of fan of Wes Craven, I think it's a movie that people should see. However, for me, it readily slides into the category of seen it once, never need to see it again.
And that was where it was for me. I'd seen it once. And then, of course, just like in listening to that podcast, I was like, well, and they had mentioned it was on Popcorn Flicks, which is an app that I have on my phone. Let me just fire this up for a second. And I'll admit to not watching it all the way through, like kind of skimming through it a little bit, because I'm like, no, I don't want to watch this. No, I don't want to watch this. We should. I mean, obviously, Patrick and Heather mentioned it, that Craven did do some adult films, you know, including The Fireworks Woman. Have you seen that movie?
I actually have not. After the podcast, I wanted to track it down, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. So I actually have nothing to contribute to the discussion of Fireworks Woman, other than Abe Snake is the greatest pseudonym for a director, I think, that there's ever been.
I agree with you. Abe Snake is the best name. Again, crediting the podcast, and I'm probably going to be mentioning it throughout the episode. It was just really good. I was able to, through a pretty extensive search, able to track a pretty shitty copy, online copy of the film. And I watched about the first 10 minutes of it. And it is, I mean, it's an adult film. Don't get me wrong. It's an adult film, but it's super stylistic at the same time. Like, it's definitely, you can tell that this is somebody who has aspirations beyond making adult films. And I'll just leave it at that.
Fair enough. That sounds like about what I would have expected it to be like.
1977, The Hills Have Eyes. Your thoughts on that film?
I like it. It's been a long time since I've watched it. I like it. I actually am one of the people that thinks the remake is the Alexandre Aja remake is actually superior on almost every level. And again, not to just keep going back to Craven, but they do a really good discussion of the differences between the two. And for whatever reason, I just really gravitate towards the remake. Part of that is the absolutely terrific score by, if I remember right, it's Tom and Andy. I think the cast resonates with me a little bit better in that one. But Hills Have Eyes is fine. It's the original is fine. It's good. It's disturbing. It's certainly, I would sort of put it mid-tier Craven. I know a lot of people would disagree with me on that, but I would sort of put it mid-tier. I don't think it's one of his best, but it's far from his worst.
But, you know, I mentioned these films because, make no mistake about it, like, he's not a household name at all during this time, correct?
No, not even remotely.
No, he's not even, I wouldn't even classify him at, by this point in 77, as a journeyman director. I mean, this is somebody who's just trying to break into the business. It's going to be 4 more years before his next film, and that's 1981's Deadly Blessing. What are your thoughts on that film?
I have to be honest, I actually have not seen Deadly Blessing. I am not a Craven completionist, so there are going to be some movies that we talk about that I haven't seen. I know it's famous for being a very early Sharon Stone performance, but other than that, I actually don't know much about it.
I was trying to track down a copy to watch, but I did not want to buy the Shout Factory Blu-ray because I just didn't want to blind buy the film. So I will defer to when Patrick and Heather talk about it to kind of get a better opinion of it, and I'll ask the listeners out there if they have seen it. His first really, I would say, first big theatrical film, big in the sense that it was based on an IP, based on a comic book, was 1982's Swamp Thing. Now, I actually remember seeing this film in the late 80s and not even realizing that it was directed by Wes Craven. And I I've only seen it that one time. And I have to ask you, Michael, is this one worth revisiting?
So I actually saw this bad boy in the theater.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was a big comic book nerd, so I knew who Swamp Thing was. And I was, you know, even though I was only about six, I still knew who he was. And so I was excited, made my parents take me to see it. It's been quite a while since I've seen it, but I actually think it's pretty good. First of all, it's got Adrian Barbeau in it, who's always just delightful to watch on screen. It's actually got Craven bringing in some of his regulars, like David Hess shows up in it. It's been long enough since I've seen it that I can't say for sure that it's, you know, something that everybody should watch, but I have very fond feelings of it and I have very fond memories of it. So I do think if people have a chance to check it out, they probably should.
It was, all things considered, fairly well reviewed. It had 65% on Rotten Tomatoes, and Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars. I mean, so, you know, people liked the movie. It wasn't wildly successful by any means. I mean, it wasn't like a box office success. Otherwise, I think it'd be more in the discussion when people talk about Craven's career, but it seems to be lost a little bit to the sands of time. I do remember one thing, that, of course, it was a film. It was a movie filled with fantastic practical effects, which there's always that. 1984, we're getting close. But before A Nightmare on Elm Street came out, Craven, and I remember Jim Hemphill talking about this, like, they set out to make The Hills Have Eyes Part 2 and didn't even have the money to finish the film, and they literally just spliced together a lot of scenes from the original film. I set out to watch this after Jim and I did our episode on the show, and it's practically unwatchable. Have you seen The Hills Have Eyes Part 2?
I have, and it's not good. You know, I mentioned that I don't consider The Hills Have Eyes to be upper echelon Craven, but it's far from his worst. I think there's a strong argument to be made that The Hills Have Eyes Part 2 is actually his worst movie. It comes across as a relatively just cheap cash in, cash grab. It's very similar, you know, a lot of horror movies in the 80s were doing this, where they were cranking out these sequels. They were being done with like no budget, and they would end up reusing a ton of footage from the earlier movie. Another one that I think of is Silent Night, Deadly Night. The sequel to that is like an 80-minute movie, and probably at least 30 to 40 minutes of it are reused scenes from the first one. And so Hills Have Eyes Part 2 kind of falls into that same category, where it's just, there's just nothing to it. It's kind of just a cheap, exploitative cash grab. It's definitely not one that I could recommend that anybody, even if you're a Craven completionist, you can kind of almost, I think, skip this one and still have your conscience clear that you've seen every worthwhile Wes Craven movie.
Absolutely. So that brings us to 1984, and arguably the most important film in Wes Craven's career, arguably the most important film in producer Robert Shea's career, and arguably one of the most important films in horror movie history. A Nightmare on Elm Street was released in 1984 on a budget of $1.8 million. The film went on to gross $57 million, although Wes Craven and Bob Shea barely saw any of that money, and we'll get to that towards the end. You already showed your cards a little bit when I was going to ask you when this film came on your radar, but if you could take me through your first viewing of A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Sure. So it was probably would have been 1985, I would say. Whenever Freddy's Revenge came out, it would have been right after that. Because I'd wanted to see it for a while. I kind of kept bugging my parents when we were at, you know, I'm such an old that this is back when you used to rent your videos at the grocery store, right?
Yes,
you
remember? Yes. Oh my God. Yes. I remember that.
Places at the grocery store. And I'd always see it because the box art had that absolutely beautiful Matthew Peake art. Right, that Matthew Peake poster art for the first handful of movies is, I think, one of the unsung reasons why the Nightmare series became so successful, because there were very few horror franchises that were doing poster and box art on the level that what he was doing with Nightmare. And so I'd always tell my parents, can we rent this? Can we rent this? And they wouldn't. And then I guess, I don't know why, but I finally convinced them as soon as Freddy's Revenge came out to rent that one. And then like a few weeks later, we went back and they rented the first one. And so I watched it, and it you know, you mentioned, Dana, that you slept with a nightlight on for like 3 or 4 years. I have a horrifically overactive imagination. I especially did when I was a kid. So I was already sleeping with a nightlight on before I watched this one. It certainly did not help that any, because I it got under my skin. It terrified the hell out of me for years. I always remembered the scene of Tina getting killed, you know, getting dragged up the walls and all of that sort of stuff. And that's burned into my memory. Now, obviously, I've seen the movie 25 times since, but I think that scene would have been burned into my memory even if I had never watched the movie again. Kind of the only thing that helped me balance it was, again, also being a big comic book reader. In my brain, I sort of equated, because they both have knives on their hands, that if Freddy ever tried to come and get me, Wolverine would protect me. And so that kind of allowed me to sleep. But not for if it wasn't for Wolverine, I probably would have had to have had a decent therapy bill because of this movie. So it messed me up for sure.
My sisters are a little bit older than me, and you know, they got a copy of a rented copy of the movie. And one Saturday morning, my brother came into my bedroom holding the copy of the movie and said, I want to show you something. And I don't know what it is about sort of the psyche of a 7-year-old, because that's how old I was at the time. But even though I was terrified, I couldn't stop watching. Does that make sense?
As a dude who watched entirely too many horror movies when he was 6, 7, you know, between the ages of 6 and 10. Absolutely. You can't turn away no matter how scared you are. And no matter how like terrifying it is to try and sleep, you keep going back to it. You keep going back to them, and you can't not.
And I kind of want to think that I might have had my trauma dealt with in a proper manner had I been able to speak to my mom about it. But I was sworn to secrecy under the guise of they'll take all the TVs out of the house if mom and dad ever find out that we watched this horror movie. So you can never say anything. So I kept it quiet for many years that I had even seen the film from my parents. My mom probably would have sat me down and been like, okay, now this is all, you know, make believe. And, you know, but I didn't get any of that therapy I think I needed. I get a kick out of that.
That's actually one of the things that I will always credit my parents for doing, is they let me watch just about anything, but they always had to watch it with me. That was always the rule. I never got to watch these movies by myself. I always watched them with my parents. That way they could explain, like, here's how it's fake. Here's, you know, it's latex. It's plastic on his head. It's not real. He doesn't really look like that. And it was actually funny, because one of the other things that helped me was I was a huge fan of the TV series V. And so that was one of the things my mom did, was she was like, you remember the guy on V? And that's who plays Freddy. And it's like, once I equated Robert Englund with his character on V in my head with Freddy, it was kind of one of those first ways where I really started realizing the films, that there were things like actors and directors and stuff like that, because I was like, oh, that's the same guy. And it made Freddy a whole lot less scary for me.
I'm very jealous that you got to experience. It's interesting, because even at 42, like, I was trying to watch this film this morning. I'm outside just watching it on my phone. I know it's sacrilege to watch it on your phone, but I've seen it 30 times. So I just, you know, just want to make sure I could keep up with the beats of the film for this discussion. But there were parts of the movie I'm just like, no, I'm going to skip past this. I know what's going to happen. I don't need to watch that. And I'm like, literally checking myself, grown man, stop it. Why don't we get into just a little bit of the cast? And we'll off the record, we'll say Robert Englund for last. All right. So the star of the movie, besides Robert Englund, would be Heather Langenkamp. How did you think she did in this film?
So this is a little bit of sacrilege, because I know Nancy is beloved and Heather Langenkamp is a wonderful human being, and she's legitimately deserving of all the credit that she gets. I have always found her performance a little bit flat in this movie. It's not bad, and the character is great, but I just have always found, until sort of the climax, the, you know, the big finale, I have always found her performance to be just a little bit flat. I think she's much stronger in the other two Nightmares that she's in. I know that's sacrilege for a lot of people, but that's just, she's never quite hit for me the way she does for a lot of others.
Well, I kind of echo what you say there. I think there's a turning point in her performance after she goes to the Dream Doctor. and pulls the hat out. And it just seems like after that, I just see just more to it, more nuance to her performance. But for the first, 30, 40 minutes of the film, I think I couldn't put my finger on how to describe it, but I think flat is a very, very apt description. There's just no depth, and I don't really feel like we even get to know who she really is. She's just sort of going along.
And some of that is also due to kind of the fake out that they pull off, where we spend so much time with Tina to start the movie that it almost seems like she's the protagonist. And so for the first part of the movie, in fairness to Heather Langenkamp, Nancy doesn't have a ton to do. Tina's sort of our starting character, and then obviously we know what happens to her, and so it shifts. I think that's partially by design, but I still don't think that excuses all of the flatness in her performance.
So that's a great way to sort of segue into the Amanda Wiss character of Tina. Obviously, this is, the great fake out. We've seen it in Psycho. It's obviously something that's been duplicated in many other movies. But again, I think it was not done that often that it still must have caught audiences by surprise in 1984. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it would have to, because it's a bold move, right? I mean, it was bold when Hitchcock did it. And that was Hitchcock. Like, for this guy who made the, inbred cannibal movie, to try and pull something like that off is a really bold move. And so I don't remember, I wasn't old enough to kind of appreciate that when I first saw it. But I have to imagine that for older viewers, that was a bit of a curveball for them.
And one of the things we're going to do in this series is, when we're talking about each one of these characters, we're going to get into the death scene, if you will, of how each one of these characters is dispatched in these films. You mentioned that you were traumatized by Tina's death. I think, and if we were going to rank sort of the most, I wouldn't want to say greatest because that sounds very morbid, but if we were to sort of rank the most powerful death scenes in this entire franchise, I mean, where does Tina's death rank for you? I mean, it's up there, obviously, in the top two or three for me.
I actually think it probably ranks first, simply because, and this is something that we're obviously going to get into as the series goes on. The deaths in the later movies, they get much more elaborate, but they also get much more comical and sort of this weird, Tales from the Crypt kind of irony. Freddy starts using his victims' weaknesses against them and stuff like that. Whereas here, Tina's death is just straight brutal. And it takes so long. I mean, it doesn't actually take that long, but when you're watching it, it just feels like it takes so long and it's so brutal. And Rod is trapped in the room with her watching this happen, but he can't do anything to help her. It is, for me, I think it is the most affecting death in the entire series. Now, again, as I said, I haven't rewatched a lot of these movies in years, so I do reserve the right to change that opinion as this retrospective goes on. But for me right now, I think it's the most affecting death in the entire series.
And it's interesting because, like you said about in later movies, he uses their weaknesses. In this particular scene with Tina, when she wakes up from bed and she hears sort of like someone's like throwing pebbles at the window, and you hear the voice call her name, and then she goes outside, and he's not being comical, he's just fucking with her, and it's terrifying that he comes up from behind the bushes, he cuts his fingers off, his arms extend out. I mean, it is terrifying, and there's not an ounce of humor in that entire scene.
Yeah, and you contrast that to like down the road when he fights the comic book kid and becomes Super Freddy. I think that's in either 5 or 6. I don't remember which one specifically, but that's 180 degree different type of kill. Because like you said, here he's just fucking with her. He's almost like playing with his food. Yeah. And it's unnerving. It's creepy as all hell.
You mentioned that Rod, played by Nick Corey in the movie, he's in the room and he's immediately a suspect. And he goes on the run, he gets caught, he's arrested, they find him with a switchblade in his pocket, and case closed. And it's very, you know, you as the audience are watching this and you're feeling bad because the introduction to Rod is he's kind of a D-bag. You know, he's kind of an asshole. He kind of treats Tina like shit, you know, the bad boy and everything. But you feel sympathy and empathy for him when he's in jail because, you know, he didn't do it, but he's going down for this crime. And his death, again, the way Freddy basically hangs him while he's, you know, the bedsheet wraps around his neck and he gets hung to make it look like, yep, he did it. And he's just killing himself because he did it. It's just really, really unnerving.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and he does. I know the actor Nick Corey in this, but he now goes by Jesu Garcia, which is a variation of his actual real name. I know he struggled a lot and has struggled a lot in life. His story is actually really interesting, but because I know he's been very upfront that he was in the throes of severe heroin addiction when he was filming this, and in fact was often high during his scenes. But he, I think, does a pretty great job as Rod in this, especially once he sees, you know, because like you said, he's a total bag of douche for the first part of the movie. But then as soon as he sees with his own eyes what happens to Tina and realizes there's something more going on here, but that he can't do anything about it, and that he knows he's going down for it, and he knows there's not a damn thing he can do to stop it. Just the dejected way he plays that, I actually think is really effective.
No, I agree. You've got Nancy and Glenn, played by Johnny Depp, visit him in, you know, in prison, when he's in jail, and he's just like, you know, this is the first time that, you know, he describes who he sees in his dreams. And, you know, Nancy, and they're all having these dreams, but they're not really talking about it, and they're all being visited by Freddy. And this is the first time that sort of Nancy has the realization when Rod's telling her, you know, this is the person that's tormenting me, and she leaves, and it's at that moment that she believes that Rod didn't do it as well. Talking about the character of Glenn, played by Johnny Depp in his first feature film, Johnny Depp, just basic thoughts on Johnny Depp.
I mean, he's Johnny Depp. Like, you know, look, Johnny Depp is an actor that I have followed not just since this movie, but in particular because he played Officer Tom Hansen on 21 Jump Street, one of my very, very favorite TV shows growing up. And so I have followed Johnny Depp most of my life. And you could see even in this one that there was something special about him, and not just because he's an absolutely stunningly beautiful human being. You could still see that there was kind of something special about him. And obviously he is a problematic as shit human being now, and has, to in my opinion, kind of lost his ability to act. I mean, he hasn't been very good in anything for the last, I don't know, probably 10 years. But when he's good, he is so good. And I'm not going to lie, the man has been in some of my very favorite movies and given some of my very favorite performances of all time. So it is always a kind of a little treat to go back and watch this one and see baby Johnny Depp in his very first role.
Yeah, I like to say it's the least Johnny Depp performance that Johnny Depp's ever given, and it's still a good performance. So
yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and I like what you said there. Like, I think it's so hard. It's, you know, and I don't want to go on a Johnny Depp tangent because, you know, I'm like, well, I want to say, well, the bigger the budget, the bigger the movie, the least interesting his performance is. But that's not true because he's amazing in that first Pirates of the Caribbean movie as Captain Jack Sparrow. I mean, he was nominated for an Academy Award for that performance. Like, he's excellent in that. But when you look at like 90s Johnny Depp, you know, movies like Donnie Brasco, or, you know, go to Blow in 2000. Blow was either 99 or 2000. I mean, that's the Johnny Depp I like the most. I really, really like him the most in those sort of subtle roles. Yeah, I think he's fine in this movie. Can I ask, let's go ahead and ask this question right now, because I've always been wondering and I've never really explored it with anyone. When Nancy says the famous line to Glenn, whatever you do, don't fall asleep. He falls asleep. Freddy's arm comes up, pulls him into the bed. What's happening to him while he's been pulled into the bed? That's the question I've always wondered, because we see the end result, but I've always been curious, like, is he just, I don't even know if we want to go down this road, but my mind has always said, well, what's happened to him when he gets pulled into the bed? Do you have any theories?
Have you seen Fargo?
Yeah. that's it.
That's what's happening to him when he gets pulled into the bed. He goes right into the wood chipper.
Yeah. Yep, that's exactly it. That is the scene where, and it was interesting how they shot that, because again, this is all practical effects. Make no mistake about it. Like, this was the scene where all the blood comes out of the bed, that was done just with a room that could literally on a gimbal that flips upside down.
Same room that they used for Tina's death scene.
Yep.
It was the same thing. They did both special effects using that same room.
Absolutely. And it was also used in the 1984 seminal classic Breaking to the Electric Boogaloo. Just want to point that out, that when Turbo is dancing all on the ceiling, same room, which I ride or die for the two Breaking movies. I love them. Would you say that's one of the most iconic shots in the entire film?
Oh, absolutely. I think the only reason I think Tina's death is more impactful is because there's an emotion there. Glenn's death is the one time where I sort of feel a little bit like this movie approaches the same territory that my beloved Sam Raimi tracks in, right? Because there's just so much blood coming out of that bed. So much blood that it almost becomes a little bit comical rather than just being brutal. It's still scary. It's still unnerving. But by the end of that scene, I find it a little hard to be that scared by it because there's just so much blood coming out.
Yeah. There's another scene in the movie that actually, at 7 years old, I switched from taking a bath to taking a shower. I think you know what scene I'm talking about, which would probably be another very iconic scene. And one of the ones that I think is probably one of the more effective scenes in the film. And that's when Nancy's taking a bath and Freddy's glove slowly comes up because she keeps falling asleep. And then I love when, you know, Marge knocks on the door and the glove comes back under and, you know, she wakes up. And when she gets pulled down into, you know, beneath the bathtub. And one of the most challenging scenes for me to watch is when she's underwater and she's struggling to get back up. And just the thought of drowning. I mean, that to me is just a powerful, powerful scene that still holds up some 36 years later.
Agreed. I think it's absolutely terrific. I mean, first of all, it really does. This is something I was going to kind of save talking about this for a little later, but I think it's really appropriate to talk about it here. You know, one of the things that made Nightmare so effective is it, and I'm not the first person to say this, it traffics in making our safe places no longer safe, our vulnerable places no longer safe. You know, the whole thing with horror movies was you always got to watch them, get scared, and then you went to bed. And the next morning, the sun came out and it was fine. And all of a sudden now, sleep is the very thing that puts us in danger. And when are we ever more vulnerable than when we're sleeping? Well, it's kind of the same thing with this scene. You know, Nancy is in such a, I mean, when are you, other than sleeping, when are you more vulnerable than naked in a bathtub? You know, I mean, you're in no position to defend or protect yourself in any capacity whatsoever. And so again, it's a space where we all take, I mean, there's an entire industry built around making your baths the relaxing place to be, right? You got your bath salts and your candles and all of that stuff. And so it's like, it's a place we go to relax. And what Craven does so well is it's like, if this is a place you feel safe, I'm going to fucking take it from you. I'm going to take every place, every last place you think you can feel safe. You viewer watching this movie, if you think you can feel safe, you get scared watching this, you think you're going to take a nice bath to relax. Nope, I'm taking that from you. You think you're just going to go to bed? Nope, I'm taking that from you. You know, it's such a brutalizing movie in that way that it just takes every last vestige of safety away from you as you're watching it and away from the characters.
Very, very well said. This movie does not get made without mentioning the following two actors, Ronnie Blakely and John Saxon. Because when Bob Shea was trying to raise the money for this film, it wasn't on the strength of Wes Craven's name. It was on the strength of the fact that, hey, we've got John Saxon and we've got Ronnie Blakely attached to this film. And that's how they were able to raise the sort of the principal investment for the movie. So they're a married couple. We'll talk about them. They're a married couple in the, well, they're a divorced couple in the movie. So we'll talk about them as a duo. Your thoughts on Ronnie Blakely, and then I know you've got some thoughts on John Saxon.
So I think Ronnie Blakely is actually pretty terrific in this. You know, she got an Oscar nomination for starring in Nashville. She was you know, one of Robert Altman's finds. And this was, you know, coming a little bit later. She didn't have quite the same cachet, but I think she's pretty terrific because what starts initially is just an absentee alcoholic mom becomes a character that has far more depth and far more nuance to it because, as we find out, you know, she participated in some, I don't want to say something horrific because it's not like Freddie didn't have it coming, but something that she still clearly feels a lot of guilt about. I think she really does help kind of provide an emotional anchor for Nancy because she's weak in a way that Nancy is strong. And it helps us as we follow through Nancy's arc in this movie to see, because of how good Ronnie Blakely's playing Marge, that Nancy is basically saying, I'm not you. I'm not going to be you. I'm stronger than you. Therefore, I'm going to figure out how to beat this guy. And I don't think that works as well if Ronnie Blakely, it would have been so easy for her character to be just completely unsympathetic for us as a viewer. But I don't think she is. I don't think she's unsympathetic at all. I think she's pitiable. I think she deserves our pity, but she doesn't deserve our hate. And that's pretty much, I think, all on Blakely, because I'm not sure that necessarily would be there on the page.
And what's interesting is, you know, you mentioned the absentee alcoholic, and you come to realize what's probably driven her to drink. But one of, I think, when Nancy starts sort of tossing around the name Fred Krueger, and there's a moment when Ronnie Blakely looks at John Saxon, there's no words spoken, but they just kind of look at each other. And when Marge has the talk with Nancy in the basement, just that great line where she says, you know, he can't hurt you anymore because mommy killed him. And I just think that was just, I just kind of got shudders when I was watching that today. It's like, she did what she had to do, and she's been tormented by it ever since, and I think that's what's driven her to drink. So I agree with you. I think she's really good in the movie, but I think upon a first-time viewing, you would not initially see that performance coming through with the first couple times she's on screen, but she really nails it. And of course, she does the, you know, completely locks up the house, has bars and the doors are locked, and she just completely, I've always thought about that a little bit. You know, does she do that to keep Nancy in? Because in her mind, she's killed Freddie already. She was one of the parents that torched him. I was wondering what her, you know, her decision to sort of lock up the entire house. I've never really gone too far into it, but what do you think?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. I think if you were to ask Marge, she's doing it to keep Nancy in. But if you were to really get her on like a psychiatrist's couch and really push her, you might get her to admit that, you know, something along the lines of deep down in her soul, she knows evil never dies. And so she is actually trying to keep something out, not so much keep Nancy in. I don't know. It's tough with this movie because on one hand, I feel like maybe we're giving it a little more credit than it's due. But then on the other hand, it's like, this movie's pretty fucking great. So yeah. I don't know that we actually are giving it more credit than it's due. I think maybe it's one of those things where the filmmakers didn't necessarily realize just how deep and sort of profound aspects of this movie were. But death of the author and all that, I think it's still there.
I agree. That brings us to John Saxon as Lieutenant Donald Thompson. Now, he doesn't want to even hear this Fred Krueger nonsense. He's like, I've killed this guy already. You know, Rod killed Tina. If there's somebody else out there, I'm going to find him. He's a tough as nails, you know, lieutenant in the Springwood Police Department. Although Springwood is never mentioned by name in this movie, but that is the town that's what the town becomes known as. I love John Saxon. I mean, I love him in everything I've ever seen. He's one of my all-time favorite. Do we even classify him as a character actor? I think he's just a great, great actor, period.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much a leading man, so I don't know that we would characterize him as a as a character actor, but he's fantastic. And, you know, for those who don't know, we did lose him July 25th of 2020, which was a big loss. I mean, he was not a young man. It wasn't, you know, like we didn't see it coming, but it was still a big loss for those who listen to the 20th Century Movie Club. You know, he's got three movies on the 20th Century Movie Club. One of my all-time favorites, Enter the Dragon, in which he is just absolutely terrific. That's the movie I had to watch after I found out he passed away. Dana, you recommended Nightmare 3. And then I also recommended Black Christmas, which he's also terrific in, playing essentially a very similar character to what he's playing here. You could actually see his character in Black Christmas turning into Lieutenant Thompson in this movie. Black Christmas, he's still a little younger, a little more hopeful and optimistic about things. And then he meets Freddy Krueger, and you could absolutely see him turning into this character.
Yeah, and I so badly want to talk about his performance in part three, but we'll get to that on the third episode because it really ties into this one, because again, he's just tough as nails. I just think it's just a really, really good performance. Speaking of Ronnie Blakely, her death, she's sucked into the bed and disappears. What do you think about this particular death scene?
It's one that doesn't have the same impact for me as a lot of the others. I think it's a bit on the weaker side. I don't really have too much to add to it other than that. It's not the most impactful death for me in the movie by any means.
Okay. And well, that's going to bring us to the man of the hour, the person that we'll be talking about in 8 episodes of this show. There will be 9 episodes, but we'll be talking about Robert Englund in 8 of them. This is easily for me, and I don't want to show my cards, this is the most terrifying version of Freddy Krueger that he put on film. When we look at your classic sort of slasher film, horror movie, you know, iconic killers, your Michael Myers, your Jasons, and you know, what are those, you know, Leatherface screams a little bit, but what do they all have in common? They don't talk, you know, they you can't reason with them, they don't explain their motivation to you, they're just this force.
They're forces of nature. Yeah. They're like Godzilla, essentially. They're just a force of nature that has to be avoided as best as you can. They're not an actual monster.
Freddy gives you drips and drabs of his motivation in this film. And he also, you know, he doesn't speak very much in this film, but when he does, it's impactful and profound by horror movie, you know, villain standards. I'm always thinking about the scene when Nancy's on the phone and Freddy says the line, "I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy." And like, to me, that just, it's just such a, I'm getting shivers again thinking about this because I'm just so traumatized by this performance, and that is such a you know, a tip of the hat to him. He's so excellent, and as we'll talk about in the second film, I don't think that even Wes Craven or Bob Shea understood how impactful Robert Englund's performance in this first Elm Street film was, because spoiler alert, you know, Bob Shea tried to replace him by the second film because they thought anybody could pull this off. So I'll turn it over to you, Mike, your thoughts on Robert Englund's performance. And I also understand that it's a little tricky because there are multiple performances of Freddy Krueger by Robert Englund, but just zeroing in on this performance, what are your thoughts?
I am with you. This is actually, I think, his best performance. I definitely prefer creepy, scary Freddy to quippy comedy Freddy, barring a couple of exceptions. I've made no secret about my love of Freddy versus Jason, which of course we'll get to down the road. But I think he's just absolutely terrific in this, because like you said, as soon as you started talking about his few lines, I immediately thought of "I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy." That's just such a memorable line in a movie of memorable moments. You know, England's just a terrific actor. He's in one of my very favorite Toby Hooper movies, a movie about a killer alligator called Eaten Alive that is really, really a great slice of 70s exploitation. And like I said, you know, in V, he is the first of the visitors that turns to side with the humans. And he's just the nicest guy in the series, in the movies and in the series. So to see him, you know, flip like this, and I mean, he's making V and Nightmare on Elm Street essentially concurrently. And so to just be able to bounce back and forth between those 280 degree different roles is really amazing. But I think this is the best, for me, the best Freddy Krueger. I think he's the right amount of playful in that, like I mentioned earlier, he's playing with his food, but that makes him even creepier. You know, I mean, the scene where he's cutting off his fingers to Tina and he's smiling while he's doing it. So it should be kind of similar to some of the more comedic stuff we get later, but it's not. It just feels icky, for lack of a better term, when he's doing it. I don't think this movie works without him. I you can talk about how much you like Nancy, how much you like John Saxon, how much you like everything. This movie does not hold together. It does not tie together. It does not become the phenomenon that it becomes without him. I just don't think there's any question. He is the absolute MVP of the movie.
And one of the things we're going to discuss with each one of the episodes is the manner in which Freddy meets his demise. So, and this is interesting, this particular film. And my thoughts are always clouded by the number of sequels that there are. But essentially, the way this film ends, and I'm not talking about the sort of the prologue, but the epilogue, with Nancy realizing that Freddy gets his powers through fear, and she turns his back on us, and I'm not scared of you anymore, you're nothing, you're shit, and he lunges at her and then he just disappears. And that will become a theme in later episodes or later installments of the franchise, but that was something that Wes Craven established, which, again, I want to talk, we'll talk about the established rules of the franchise throughout the series, but that was a very important one that he established. So your thoughts on the way Freddy meets his demise in this film?
Well, I'm with you in that this is one of those movies, you know, every once in a while you see those Twitter memes where people are like, what's a movie that you wish you could unsee so you could watch it again for the first time? This would actually be on that list. It might not be at the top because it is so hard watching it now. I feel like that ending feels a bit anticlimactic, but that's only because of all the sequels that we've gotten that have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, at the point that your series is culminating with him fighting Jason Voorhees, doing friggin', you know, Muay Thai moves on Jason, like it's a little hard to look at this ending and say, oh, well, that ending really, really is perfect. But then if I can block all that out and just think of this as when they made this, there was no intention of doing a sequel, at least on Craven's part. Obviously, Bob Shea had different ideas. And for this to be a self-contained movie that tells a complete story arc of Nancy Thompson discovering sort of her inner strength, I think it's a perfect ending. I think it's the only way the movie could have ended. The ending is only lessened by the fact that we got 8 other Nightmare on Elm Street movies. If you just take it in a vacuum, I think it's the perfect ending for the movie. And I mean that because you said we're not talking about the epilogue yet. I mean that the way this ends is the perfect ending for the movie. I will just leave that about the epilogue there.
This is a perfect time to bring up the epilogue because that's not something that Wes Craven wanted to do.
No, not at all. He was absolutely pressured into it, you know. And Bob Shea, God love him, the man knows how to make movies that make money, and he knew that there was a potential franchise here. But no, Wes absolutely didn't want it, didn't want anything to do with it. In fact, on the Blu-ray, there's about 3 or 4 different versions of that epilogue that are all some variation of it that they went back and forth on because at one point, Freddy was going to be driving Glenn's car instead of Glenn. And Marge wasn't going to get sucked through the door. And, you know, they settled on the striped hood of the car and Marge getting sucked through the door. And I think it's fine. I'm not a fan of those kind of stingers in most horror movies. And this is actually something that's going to come up in this series in particular when we get to part 4. Because I am very anti in horror movies, the last minute kill your survivors or the bring them back in the next movie to kill them. I think that's not playing fair. I think that's playing dirty. If you survive a horror movie, you get to just fuck off and go live in your post-traumatic stress someplace in, you know, you get to retire to Ocala, Florida with your post-traumatic stress. Yes. and go about your life. You don't get brought back to get killed, or you don't get killed in the very last seconds. I actually absolutely despise the epilogue. I think the ending of the movie is perfect. I think it should have ended with Nancy walking out, getting in the car, and her mom basically saying, you know, I just don't feel like drinking that much anymore. I think I'm going to stop. I think that's how the movie should have ended. You could have come back and done a sequel. You could have done the exact same sequel without having that stinger ending. It's the one part of the movie that I just absolutely detest.
And it had to be done because by this point, Bob Shea had, you know, the way he had structured sort of the financing for this film was that, like, New Line wasn't even going to make any money off of this thing if it was successful, but Bob Shea would have the rights to any sequels. He's a smart guy. He knew he had to do something to sort of tease the audience that, hey, there's more of this coming if you want it. And Wes Craven, he was getting nothing. You know, he saw no profits from this film. Neither did Bob Shea. They didn't see any profits from this film. I mean, the movie made $57 million, but that all went to the investors in the movie. That's an interesting conversation to have as we get into episodes 2 and 3, because, and we'll talk a little bit about the fact that Wes Craven did not come back for the sequel. But before we wrap this episode up, this one's going to be pretty easy. Mike, is there anything you don't like about this movie?
I mean, I pretty much just said it. I detest the epilogue, the stinger. That's really the only thing, though. I think everything else in this, as much as I said that I didn't think that Heather Langenkamp's performance was all that spectacular for the first part, that's a minor quibble. I really think that pretty much everything else in this movie is terrific. We you know, people heard it at the start. The music is terrific. I mentioned the poster art. I just think everything about this movie is pretty great. Like I said, I'm not the nightmare diehard that a lot of people are, but I still think that this movie is pretty fantastic.
And I'm gonna just second all of that. I mean, I'm not crazy. Like you said, I'm not crazy about the epilogue, although I do like the, like you mentioned, the alternate versions of it. I kind of like the Freddy driving the car thing. I kind of chuckled the first time I saw that. I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting. But it serves no purpose, but it's going to happen at the end of every Nightmare on Elm Street film moving forward. So spoiler alert on that. You know, just the, as you put it, sort of the stinger, the hook. Don't go away for too long. We're going to be back. I'm not going to ask you what you like about the film because we've already discussed that, but I will ask you this question. Michael, would you recommend 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street?
Oh, 100%. Like, this is an all-time classic. I can't imagine that a horror fan hasn't seen this movie, so this is more directed to people who might not consider themselves horror fans, which actually, Dana, I know you don't always like the ooky gory horror, so, but this is one that I think is an all-time classic. I think this is up there with John Carpenter's original Halloween. I think even though I'm a Friday the 13th guy, I think it's vastly superior to every movie in the Friday the 13th series. I think Friday 6 is maybe the only one that could even come close, and that's more akin to the later Nightmares. You know, I would argue that this is probably one of the 10 best horror movies ever made. I think it's up there with Halloween. I think it's up there with The Exorcist. I can't recommend it. I actually probably recommend this more highly than I recommended First Blood in the Rambo retrospective. That's how good. Wow. I think this is.
Okay.
This is Terminator 1 good for me.
That is one hell of an endorsement based on the conversations we've had in the past, and I really can't do anything more than just say I second every bit of that. I know I talked about how much this film affected me as a child, but that doesn't change the fact that I don't recognize that it is one of the most brilliant horror movies I've ever seen. And, you know, it's jumpstarts a franchise which I have. And I don't want to show my cards here because I'm not going to be specific, but it jumpstarted a franchise where there are movies in the franchise beyond this film that I really like, and there are movies in this franchise I think are the absolute worst. And I mean worse than, you know, Terminator Salvation worse. Two movies in this franchise I've seen once or twice and I don't ever want to see again, but I'm going to have to watch again for this retrospective. So it's not like I'm laying my cards out saying, oh, I'm going to be just praising every one of these movies moving forward. No, there are some that I don't like at all, but this one sits atop the mountain by itself. Like, it is perfect, perfect horror movie.
I agree. Although I will say, again, not to lay my cards out, this is, while I think this is by far and away the best of the series, like just objectively the best, it is actually not my favorite. My favorite one is still to come. And it's actually not even the one that I revisit the most. I don't even revisit my favorite the most, but, so there's going to be two coming down the pipeline that I'm going to have very high opinions on. Much like you though, there's a couple coming down that I am, and just as a little teaser, I think one in particular that quite a lot of people seem to really enjoy that I just cannot stand. And so that's going to be a little, I may change my opinion when I rewatch it, but that's going to be a little bit of an interesting conversation when we get to it.
Excellent. All right. All right. One down, eight to go. Mike, if people want to follow you on social media.
Yeah, you can follow me at Hibachi Justice on Twitter. You can also follow me at Hibachi Justice on Letterboxd, where if you've listened to the show, you know I also help co-host the 20th Century Movie Club, and you'll find my continually updating list of movies we've recommended on that. And, I have also started recently a new podcast, Adkins Undisputed, the most complete Scott Adkins podcast in the world. So if you want to follow me on that, you can also follow me on Twitter at Adkins Pod. And that show is now available, and Dana will be gracious enough to include a link to that show in this episode's show notes for me, because he is a good friend and I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And all right. And if you want to follow the show on Twitter, you can do so at Dana Buckler Show. You can follow me on Twitter at Real Dana Buckler. You can follow the show on Instagram at The Dana Buckler Show. You can email the show with questions or comments at thedanabucklershow@gmail.com. So, Mike, it's good to be back. It's good to be back chatting with you. It's been too long.
Yeah, I missed you, buddy. This was a blast. Nightmare 2 is one that I have not revisited in many years. And certainly, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of what we'll probably talk about, but there's been some reevaluations of the themes involving that movie. And I honestly haven't revisited it since all of that stuff has kind of come out. So I'm really excited to revisit that one and dig into the next episode.
Again, not to show the cards here, but Elm Street 2 was recommended on an episode of the 20th Century Movie Club. For the listeners out there, there's a great documentary that I think you should, if you're going to watch Elm Street 2 in preparation for our conversation, there's a documentary called Scream Queen about Mark Patton and sort of his journey post Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which I strongly recommend. It's really good. So there's going to be lots to talk about. I'm really excited to really dive into this franchise, because I knew between the two of us, it was kind of going to be universal praise for this first film. But I don't know your opinions on most of these films moving forward, and we're going to keep it that way until we actually start recording. So I'm really looking forward to this. This is going to be a lot of fun. So Mike, thank you as always for being on the podcast.
Thank you, my friend. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And my name is Dana Buckler, and thank you so much for listening.